This podcast is brought to you by GE. Imagination at work.
They hear things louder. They often see things clearer.
I think I peaked when I was maybe 6 years old. I think that was when I knew the most stuff.
Most of human progress is due to the efforts of top 1%.
They have the capacity to change the way we live, absolutely.
She wants to do everything and she thinks she can.
And I wake up in the morning and go, wait, did that? Wow, it does work.
There's a lot of different knowledge and a lot of different answers out there.
Will she change the world?
I think she already has.
I'm Lily Cerner, and welcome again to Decoding Genius. Genius is rare, it's unstoppable, and it offers unlimited potential, but it needs a starting point. This week, we'll explore where geniuses get their inspiration from.
Suddenly, you know, all the lights come on, and you go, oh my goodness, I figured it out.
Meet Maya Bahanpakkar, a teenager who's found inspiration in a hospital in India, in her grandfather's living room, and then on a glacier in Greenland.
So I emailed all these professors and I said, hey, I have this great idea. Can I work in your lab? Oh, and by the way, I'm 10.
Maya's achievements are just the starting point. We'll also tackle the question of designer babies and genetic engineering for intelligence.
Basically, once we have control of these genetic technologies, we will have control over our own future evolution.
For GE, this is Decoding Genius.
Nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you.
I'm in Toronto, Canada, where Maya Bahanpakkar is going at light speed in half a dozen different directions.
I want my job to be able to help people in some way. I'm an incredibly empathetic person, so it's really important to me that the work I do has relevance to the real world and can have a positive impact on people in the real world.
Her search for meaningful pursuits has taken her to some of the world's most renowned research facilities.
So one summer I did some work at the Institute for Quantum Computing, and I was working on developing quantum key distribution technologies and those kinds of things, just the very basics, learning sort of like a crash course in graduate level quantum cryptography. And then the next summer I did some work tracking near-Earth asteroids for the Harvard Smithsonian, so that was very cool. And then this past summer I was working at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics and learning all about the cutting edge of physics right now.
This frantic schedule is not actually a recent phenomenon. At the age of 10, Maya devised a new smart antibiotic. At 12, she joined the hunt for the cure to Alzheimer's disease. She filmed her first documentary on climate change at age 14. And now, at the tender age of 17, she's got even bigger plans.
So I'm working on, with a team at the University of Toronto, we're trying to develop an autonomous robotic wheelchair for people with severe disabilities, physical disabilities like quadriplegia and things of that nature. So I'm doing that for half the year, and I'm also going to be hopefully working on a theoretical physics project. They recently built a radio telescope in British Columbia that's going to be mapping the 3D structure of the young universe, and I'm hoping to do some work maybe with gravitational waves or pulsars or supernovas or something in that area as well, at the Perimeter Institute for the second half of the year.
It's a plan that the word ambitious doesn't even come close to describing, and something that only a true genius would attempt.
Let's start at the beginning. It seems like a good place to start.
I spent a lot of time at my local public library. They used to have a much larger borrowing limit, maybe 20 items, something like that, per card. And we had 3 cards in our family, one for me, one for my mom, and one for my dad. And I remember every single time I went there, I would max out each of those cards.
What did you enjoy reading?
Everything. When I was little, I think I peaked when I was maybe 6 years old. I think that was when I knew the most stuff.
Still downhill from there, yeah.
Still downhill.
Maya's career in biomedical research started at the age of 10 on holidays of all places.
I was on a vacation or a family trip to India to visit some relatives, and my grandmother actually runs a small practice in India. It's focused on paralysis, but they also do general medical stuff as well. That was where I sort of got my first inspiration for my first research project, which was trying to develop drugs that would kill harmful bacteria but not cause negative side effects.
She knew that her mother always used the same traditional herbs in her cooking, and she'd been told that they were there to keep them healthy. She figured these could be the basis of her new miracle drug.
So I emailed all these professors and I said, hey, I have this great idea. Can I work in your lab? Oh, and by the way, I'm 10. I didn't get a lot of responses, and the ones that I did said, you know, no, you really can't work here, Maya, you're 10. So then I told my parents, okay, well, I'm going to build a lab in the basement.
How on earth did you get your parents to listen to you at 10 years old?
I think what happened was they sort of didn't think I would actually do it. And then when they saw, oh no, she's actually doing it, then they thought, okay, well, we should probably get on board with this because she's clearly determined. But my parents have always been super great. I mean, they never told me that any project was too big or any goal was too ambitious. And they were kind of the ones that probably kept me in good health over the years. They were sort of the ones who would say, okay, Maya, it's 3 a.m. Maybe it's time for you to go to bed now. You've been working for a very long time.
All those late nights resulted in the development of an antibiotic that selectively kills harmful bacteria, but preserves the body's helpful ones. 2 years later, at the age of 12, another personal moment gave Maya a new direction for her scientific research.
My grandfather passed away after suffering for years from Alzheimer's disease, and I got to spend a lot of time with him during that time, just because he was living so nearby, and so I visited him almost every day. I think it was that really drove me to try to do something when I thought, okay, I can tackle Alzheimer's disease, I can do it.
This is the unbelievable part of Maya's journey. She's not even a teenager at this stage, and planning to take on a cure for Alzheimer's.
At the time, we weren't totally sure what was going on, but one of our guesses was that there were these plaques that formed in the brain called A-beta plaques, and those were what characterized Alzheimer's and many other neurodegenerative diseases. And so I guess I was 12-ish year old me went in there and said, okay, so as long as we can find something that kills these plaques and also is able to breach the blood-brain barrier, there we go, Alzheimer's miracle drug. And so I did some research and I found two compounds that possess these properties, which is fairly rare, and I then applied that to the development of an Alzheimer's drug.
That's incredible.
What I'm finding is that genius has a way of making these achievements, these inspirations, sound almost every day. But how does Maya's mind work when she gets that idea?
Yeah, I think that people sort of imagine that there's this sort of eureka moment, and then suddenly, you know, all the lights come on, and you go, oh my goodness, I figured it out, and then you run out into the hall and go, everybody, I figured it out. But in my experience, that might happen for some people, but in my experience, that's never what's happened for me. It's sort of, you know, it's 3 a.m, and you go, sort of circle two things on a notebook, and then I go, oh, those two things are... Oh! And then you just sort of think about it for a while and say, no, that couldn't work, no. And then I'll go to sleep and I wake up in the morning and go, wait, did that... Wow, it does work! And it's sort of it's a very gradual process.
As she started high school, it appeared that Maya was really destined for a career in medical research. But no, she had another out-of-left-field inspiration. Her success in national science fairs won her a trip to Greenland.
One of the things that really shocked me when I went there was that there were real people, real Inuit people, who've been living in the Arctic, who are being affected in ways that are just unbelievable because of climate change. And the really sad thing is that these people live in such a sustainable fashion. They did almost nothing to cause climate change, and yet they're the ones who are facing the brunt of it.
So at 14, she produced a documentary to tell their story. It's called 400 Parts Per Million. In essence, this refers to the amount of carbon dioxide currently found in the atmosphere, a key measurement for climate scientists. But the story that Maya tells isn't about science. It's actually about people. Here's a taste.
It was in Umanak that I realized that climate change is so much more than the statistics that we learn about in school. Sometimes we think of climate change as a small problem that won't impact humans for decades. But this couldn't be further from the truth. Umanak's economy is dependent upon fishing, but climate change is making fishing nearly impossible.
What was the general reaction from the documentary?
Oh, it was extremely positive. The documentary recently won the prestigious International Barron's Prize, and so I'm very excited about that. And I've gotten emails from people from around the world saying that they're showing it at their conference or you know, in classrooms around the world and in everywhere from Latvia to China to Australia.
Maya's projects are all over the map, largely because her inspirations come from all around the world. That's a credit to her parents, who gave her a chance to travel extensively from a very young age. Their approach to raising a gifted child, according to her father Vivek, was to open as many doors as possible, but never pushing their child through them. Quite the opposite. They spent the early years trying to hold her back.
I think the challenge is having too many things that you want to get done and thinking you can do all of them. Our advice has been to slow down, and she'll have none of that. She doesn't want to. She wants to do everything, and she thinks she can. And I'm beginning to think she can as well.
Do you have to kind of bring yourself back to reality that this is quite remarkable for a 10-year-old kid to want to explore antibiotics?
I'm not sure that we really felt it was that remarkable. I think what we've always emphasized to Maya is that you can do anything and nothing is impossible. So when 10-year-old Maya comes to us and says, I want to try developing a smart antibiotic, well, sure, that's it. Anything is possible, you know, so go ahead and try. Tell me how you want to do it.
Does she get frustrated at all? Does she make mistakes? Or does she just learn something and she just gets it?
I've never seen her be frustrated. To the contrary, when she doesn't understand something, she becomes more determined. So she becomes more focused. From what I've seen, she loves that challenge of, okay, well, I don't get this, but that's the challenge. So now I am going to get it for sure. So it's kind of like a mountain climber, I suppose, looking at a really, really tough mountain to climb and being even more determined to climb it. You know, right now she's studying things that are really on a postgraduate level, and she hasn't even started university yet.
Through her teens, all of Maya's formal education had been in the Canadian public school system.
Well, I find English class really exciting because one of the areas that I haven't explored as much is works of literature, and so I found English class to be very engaging and exciting, and, you know, maybe I wish it progressed a bit faster, but it was still very interesting in terms of the content I was learning. But especially in, I think, some of the science and math courses, it could get a bit slow.
Some gifted kids get so bored they act out. Worse yet, they quit school altogether.
Hi there, welcome.
In Noosa, Australia, Dr. Kirsten Bolsch has started a program for the brightest children to spend time with their peers.
So we've had about 60 children in class today, learning all sorts of interesting things around mathematics and science.
Dr. Bolsch started her program because she saw so many parents struggling when their children were diagnosed as gifted.
These children who are sort of in the top 2% or sometimes in this case 0.01% often are so far intellectually above their age grouping that they are incredibly frustrated at school and they have difficulty having meaningful conversations with other children. And it's not that there's anything wrong with them, there's so much that's right with them, but it's just in the chronological grouping in schools that often doesn't suit these children.
Dr. Bolsch has a unique perspective on the issue. You see, she's both an academic who has studied high achievers and the mother of a gifted son. He's showing the same insatiable desire to learn that Maya did 10 years ago.
If they're allowed, they'll drive it in a certain direction of interest. They'll drive the pace of learning. They'll show you when they've mastered a concept, and gifted children learn things with one or two repetitions, not 8 or 9 or 12. So the responsiveness to the pace of learning is critical.
This ability to be able to grasp concepts quicker is one of the fundamentals you have to take into account when teaching a gifted child.
A child who's been educationally well managed and has developed a good self-concept and character will be seen in the world doing amazing things and doing genius things and using all their gifts and talents for their pleasure and for betterment of society. Yeah, I think they have the capacity to change the way we live, absolutely, if only we let them do it, release the brakes and let them fly.
As important as genetics are, environment is still a strong ingredient in the success of geniuses. Maya's world includes family and friends and a handful of mentors that help provide direction. One of those is an economics and business expert named John Wilkes.
I think she's still at the get ready and go stage of her life, let's face facts. She has the ability to change or morph into almost anything you can imagine in terms of professional. She could be in business with a focus on biotech. She could be involved in cybernetics. She could be involved in creating new cures to diseases we don't even understand it these days.
What advantages does that bring, that multidisciplinary interest?
She'll probably be able to see things that present in a fashion that may across disciplines. She may come up with solutions that other people simply wouldn't have seen by virtue of her capacity to see all these other disciplines. And similar to what's happening in various marketing groups today, where you get all kinds of people from a variety of backgrounds in the same room, and you kind of work out a way to find new solutions to new problems.
This is a big question. What does her future hold for her?
I would expect in a number of years, just expect to hear from her in some fashion, or read about her, or see her on television. There's going to be something that she does that's going to be absolutely extraordinary.
John has highlighted something that I've been thinking about a lot, actually. Maya works in so many disciplines at once. I can't figure out if it's a flaw or an advantage.
So you've gone from antibiotics research, Alzheimer's, documentary making. That's a lot of topics and really complex topics. Are there advantages of being so diverse, or, you know, in a world that people strive to specialise in a particular topic, where do you sit?
If you look at throughout history, most of the great innovators we know of have been incredible polymaths. People were poets and astronomers and mathematicians and engineers all at the same time, and they were able to draw inspiration from a variety of fields to be able to create innovations in their own field. And so I think that that's really the centerpiece of innovation, is being able to see a concept in an area that you think is totally unrelated to what you're working on, and then realize that you can actually apply it in a new way to your own field. And that can only happen if you know about things that are going on in areas other than your own field. So I definitely think there's a huge value in being both a generalist and a specialist.
It's so exciting to talk about where Maya might be going and what she might do. But before we can go any further with that, we really need to figure out just where she gets her smarts from. In really simple terms, I want to find out if it's nature or nurture.
Hello, how are you?
Professor Stephen Chu is at Michigan State University in America. He is one of the world's leading experts in genetics and genius. Professor Chu has been poring over the human genome, trying to find the genetic roots of genius.
I'll make a bold claim, which is that within the next 5 or 10 years, we'll understand to some degree the genetic architecture of human intelligence. In other words, we'll know which genetic variants, the regions of DNA where people differ from each other, which of them are leading to slightly increased or slightly decreased intelligence in the individual. And when you aggregate up all of those different variants that people have, that will allow you to actually predict that person's, say, IQ score.
So in a sense, there is a gene for genius?
There's not a gene. It is probably on the order of something like 10,000 genetic variants. So there are about 3 billion base pairs in your DNA. So a priori, there are about 3 billion different places at which you could differ from me. Now, humans are very inbred. We're a kind of recent species, recently developed species. The amount of variation in our population is small. So if I look at a particular region of DNA, the chances that you and I differ at that particular place is about 1 in 1,000. And a, quote, genius, as we were defining the term earlier, is someone who just happens to have more of the plus variants, the elevating versions at those 10,000 locations, than the average person.
Being able to recognize which genetic patterns lead to genius is step one. The science to do that is pretty much already here. Step two is to peek into the genetic code of an embryo and make a decision whether or not to select that one to become your child.
People who are doing, for example, in vitro fertilization, they already have a problem, which I call the embryo selection problem, which is that typically you overproduce embryos more than you intend to implant. You have to try to pick the best one. And currently that's done in a very crude way by looking at just the shape or morphology of the embryo and deciding this one looks normal, let's implant it. But with existing genetic technologies, you could genotype all the embryos you produce and just pick the best one. And you might pick based on intelligence, you could pick based on health or other things too. But as that proceeds, I will just predict that wealthy people will increasingly choose to have healthier and smarter babies using this technology.
That's an incredibly bold statement. On the one hand, I can see how every parent would want their child to have the best attributes they can give them. But I really wonder, how is this going to play out for society?
You'll have news stories about some kid whose father is a billionaire and the kid is a mathematical genius and world-class pianist and also, you know, 6'6" and on the national volleyball team. And people who can't afford that kind of thing will be very angry.
Does it scare you?
I guess I'm I'm kind of on the side of techno-optimism, so it does not scare me. I think it's going to go the way I just said. There are negative aspects to that. There are also positive aspects.
I think you could easily make the case that most of human progress is due to the efforts of top 1% or top 0.1% or top 0.01%. What they find is if you measure kids when they're 12 and you compare, say, top 1 percentile kid to 1 in 10,000 kid, you find the 1 in 10,000 kid is much more likely to have authored a novel, have patents to his or her name, have a PhD in a difficult subject. The probabilities just keep going up and up and up as you go further in the tail. So there seems to be no diminishing returns.
Are you saying that it would be better?
I'm not saying that we know for sure whether it would be better. I think in certain ways it would be predictably better. Some of these tools for rationality and decision-making are not available to people below some threshold level of IQ. And if most of your population is below that threshold level, you cannot expect in a democracy to have very good governance. If, for example, global warming is a giant IQ and collaboration test for the human race, we have to sort of figure out that we're damaging our planet. We have to organize ourselves to stop damaging the planet. It's very plausible to me that we're going to fail that test. However, a group of humans with, say, 30 points more IQ on average would possibly figure it out, organize themselves, and save themselves before destroying their environment.
There's something on the horizon that really frightens me. So according to Professor Xu, we're about 10 to 20 years away from having the ability to not just select embryos based on predicted intelligence, but actually manipulate the genetic codes to make them super geniuses.
Imagine that I have 10,000 variants that are affecting your intelligence. So if you have the plus version on one of these 10,000 sites, it makes you half an IQ point higher or something like this. And I arranged to have a baby born that had literally all the pluses. How smart would that baby be? And the answer is, again, this is a purely theoretical calculation. It's just for the purpose of illustration. But you get an IQ of like 1,000. So way beyond the 100, which is the average today, or the 200, which is what a genius today would have.
Basically, once we have control of these genetic technologies, we will have control over our own future evolution in a very strong way. And I think that's inevitable.
Professor Xu, thank you so much for your time. It is genuinely frightening to me that we could be engineering the brains of the next generation in a test tube. But I can certainly become more of an optimist like Professor Xu if it means a world with more people like Maya. I'm going to go back to Toronto to meet with her one last time. It's her first day at a very special school, a place she's hoping to find inspiration for her next amazing project.
If we can give a round of applause to our 25 amazing fellows.
Maya, hey.
Hi, good to see you again.
Yeah, nice to see you too.
Maya was accepted into Harvard. She decided to defer and take a year off. But this will be a gap year like no other. She's joining Studio Y, an incubator for big thinkers.
Over the next 8 months, we are going to push them. We're going to ask them to look at how do we engage our province.
As she so often is, Maya is the youngest person in the room by at least 5 years.
Oh, I'm just so, so excited. When I decided to take a gap year before going to Harvard, originally I didn't really know what I was going to do. I thought maybe some travel, maybe a bit of research on the side. But now at this point, so many different opportunities and projects have coalesced. And I'm just so excited to be working on this robotics project and then working on a theoretical physics project. And it's all very, very exciting.
Kay Dyson Tam is one of Maya's course leaders at Studio Y.
So they're the best and brightest young innovators and leaders in their sectors, and we bring them here with the hopes that they'll take their individual success and become systems leaders who can make wide-scale change at a systems level.
What is it that got Maya selected into this program?
I think it boils down to humility. She's incredibly accomplished for her age, no doubt. But she's also very young, and it takes a lot to be able to compete with those who are 10 years older than her in this leadership program, collaborate with them, integrate and share learnings. But her willingness to dig into a problem, to be intellectually curious and humble, it was something that I think stood out above and beyond in our conversations with her mentors and her interviews.
Why is humbleness important?
Because you're not going to be right 100% of the time. There's a lot of different knowledge and a lot of different answers out there. And working in a systems context, you need to be able to talk to those around you that likely hold wisdom that you haven't heard yet.
In your opinion, do geniuses have a real responsibility to society?
Yes, absolutely. It's not enough to succeed in your own right, to be top of a sinking society, of a dismantling society, you have a responsibility as you go up to bring those with you. I think this also comes when you think about the types of problems you're willing to solve. You can be shiny, but it isn't enough. And so looking at problem solving, things that are important to society is really something that we emphasize.
The year ahead for Maya will be filled with lectures, group projects, and experimentation. But will it result in her finding that one thing to specialize in? It sure doesn't sound like it.
The purpose of me taking this gap year was really to continue to explore myself and the world around me and just gain more experience in a wide variety of areas. And one of the areas that I have a little bit of experience, but certainly not enough, is in entrepreneurialism. And so that's what I'm really hoping to get out of this program. We're given a grant to pursue a project, and so I'm hoping that I can use this opportunity to develop my entrepreneurial skills and that kind of thing. But at the same time, throughout the gap year, I'm also working on a variety of projects. I think that what this gap year is all about is trying to explore as many diverse areas as I possibly can to gain more experience and figure myself out a little bit more.
Considering everything she's accomplished already, it will be stunning to see what she comes up with when she actually figures herself out. But I suppose that's what makes her unique.
One last question. Without being too modest, and I know that you're very modest, how would you describe yourself in three words?
Curious, passionate, and empathetic. I think are the three words.
That's lovely. Thank you so much for your time, Maya. It's been
great. Thank you.
When the microphone was turned off, one of Maya's mentors said to me very quietly, "Remember her name. You'll be hearing it soon. Connected to something very big." And you know, I think he's right. I don't know whether it'll be in medicine or politics or business, but I truly believe that we'll be hearing a lot more from Maya Bahanpakkan. And that's the end of this, the second episode of Decoding Genius. I want to thank the experts who have joined us, Professor Stephen Shu and Dr. Kirsten Bolsch. And of course, it was an amazing experience to spend time with Maya and her family and friends in Canada. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast in iTunes or via your favourite podcatcher app. Share our journey with your friends and be sure to check out further details at decodinggenius.com.au. Our journey continues on our next episode when we meet Mitchell Clark, a computer whiz from Perth, who started his first IT company at 10 years old.
I do lay back some nights and go, wow, I'm sitting on a company with, you know, 400 clients and all of that. So,
at the age of 17.
Yeah, so it is pretty intense.
Till next time, I'm Lily Cerner. Thanks for joining us.
This podcast was brought to you by GE, Imagination at Work.